Screw it, we're just gonna talk about comics.
Hello, welcome to Screw It, we're just gonna talk about comics. That's comic books, everybody. My name is Will Hines. I'm one of the two co-hosts of this show. And let me introduce the other one.
That's me. He's talking about Kevin Hines, Will's brother and co-host.
Yes, this is the only podcast where two guys are talking about comic books. They also happen to be brothers, and we're sort of comedians. And yeah, we're happy to be here.
Yeah. This is our Mutants and Mailbags periodic episode. Yeah. We just did one 2 weeks ago, so right now it's very regular, but it won't be this regular always. It's where we'll talk about Uncanny X-Men by Chris Claremont and then read some emails.
Yeah, this is, as we've said before, Chris Claremont's X-Men run is a huge glaring gap in Kevin's and my knowledge.
We've often said it is one of, if not, it is definitely the most important Marvel run since the 60s. Birth of Marvel, and yet we had not read it.
And what's extra dumb is it was going on while we were reading, like when we were kids, like when we were like hardcore, like reading like everything that was coming out. Like
I was like, but only the best parts of it.
So it is kind of extra dumb that we missed it. I guess, well, I don't know. So we're making up for that by giving half an episode now and then to the X-Men. And today we're starting with X-Men 98.
Yeah, we're going to cover 98 to 103.
Mm-hmm. And I'm loving it. And then we're going to do some emails too. We're going to go over some emails. So Kev, should we dive into this mutant stuff?
Let's get into it, Will.
So I'm on the side of the Sentinels. I'm like, let's get rid of...
Interesting.
Get rid of the muties. I say muties go home. Mm-hmm. Who needs them? You know what I mean? Yep. As a homo sapien, I am freaked out by these homo superiors.
I should point out, Will, that you've often chosen the wrong side in these sorts of things. I know you were a pro Mussolini guy for a while.
He seemed on top of his stuff. He seemed, a little brutal, a little murdery, but...
You let Trump stay at your place when he was in L.A., when he was trying to run for president.
Only because we were going to voting machines and trying to stop the steal, baby. Stop
sure,
the steal.
Yeah. So I just feel like, just be careful about which side you pick.
I'm still waiting for the book chameleon.
The book is called Uncanny X-Men, not those wondrous Sentinels.
I never read the titles of books. I just, those wondrous Sentinels. What a book. I mean, just like a book whose narrator is in love with the Sentinels. Just like those wondrous Sentinels. That sounds like a really happy, like the Magnificent Ambersons kind of like mid, like 1940s or 50s old movie or something.
It sounds like a... like a propaganda documentary that would show like students, right? Like about like
those wondrous Sentinels,
the amazing abattoir and the wondrous Sentinels, a modern marvel of mutant killing.
How lucky we are to have these big purple and blue. Mm. I do like the Sentinels color scheme. They're very rad.
I overall loved these six issues we read. I do have weird little problems with it, like not problems.
Ooh, I love it. I love the Kevin Hines hot takes.
Yeah,
I do admire your taste, and I am one to get very caught up with enthusiasm when I'm reading something, and I get temporarily blind to faults.
Well, some of my complaints are just basically true of probably all 70s comics, right? Like some of the issues with this is just like how quick certain things progress, like. Throughout this issue, Storm talks about how Jean is like her good friend. And I'm like,
they met spent like three
one
issues
issue together. Yeah. Yeah. Like Jean wasn't in the first few issues. She showed up to say, have a good vacation, Professor X. And now they're best friends.
Yeah.
And like, that feels very weird to me.
Yeah. That is a real old comic booky thing where they want a relationship to exist, so you're just told that it exists. This is like in the old Kirby FFs when we were told how smart Reed was, but he rarely did anything smart. We were just told he was smart.
Yeah. So there's a couple moments in these like five or six issues where it just feels like we've zipped past. We're just like we're treating this team like it's been around already for 20 years. Like if I picked up these six issues and not the five before it, I would assume this had been the team for a while. Like when they face Juggernaut, he knows who they are.
Yeah.
Everyone hates, everyone's like, oh, these are the X-Men. And I'm like, wouldn't you see these guys and go like, hey, where's Angel? Where's right. Iceman? Like, yeah. This is not the team I expected. Cyclops wasn't even there. Like, yeah. There's nobody that Juggernaut has ever fought before, mm-hmm. I think. And he's just like, ah, the X-Men, finally I'll defeat you. It's like, well, you'll defeat, I don't know. It'd be like, the last time I faced the Red Sox, Ted Williams hit a home run off me. Now I'm going to get him. And then like Dustin Pedroia comes up to bat and I'd be like, I'm going to get you finally. He's like, I don't know you, dude.
Not just that, but Dustin Pedroia, good base running skills, good power and average. Like, he knows everything about these guys.
Yeah, right.
That is the thing about like older comics. I feel like whatever the reader knows, just everybody in the universe kind of magically knows for the sake of like speeding along the plot.
There's also this weird thing. And again, overall, I think these six issues are better than the previous five we read.
We're already seeing like modern X-Men start to take shape pretty fast.
Yeah. But there's something about like the first five issues we read 2 weeks ago, where they were like fighting Eric the Red, a character I've never heard of. and then who else? And they like fought some like dream monsters. And like this issue, the Sentinels come back and they look cool, but they're also like weaker versions. And like, I guess it, like modern reboots have sort of changed how I read this, because I sort of read this and go like, well, this might have gotten a lot of new readers in, like, oh, who are these new characters? I'm going to pick up this comic. I've never read X-Men before. And they picked this up and be like, it's the Sentinels again. I'm like, well, I've never seen them before. Oh, these are weak, easily destroyed robots. They don't seem that cool.
So you're saying there's no reason to bring back bad versions of the old continuity, because your new readers don't care. And you're also doing bad versions of it. So you can only take the very best of the old stuff.
Overall, I would think if I was going to reboot the X-Men, like if X-Men only existed as the movies and 30 years had passed, I'm like, hey, remake the movies. I would be like, all right, let's take the best stuff from those movies and then new stuff, not any of the bad stuff right now until we need it.
Yeah.
And certainly it wouldn't be like, oh, X-Men 2 is a really good movie. Let's bring back those characters, but like depower them.
Okay.
That'll be an interesting twist. Kev,
I love all of your, this is sincere. I love all your takes on comics. It's one of the things I look forward to in this podcast, but I'm going to push back a little bit. I have a weird pushback.
Oh, okay.
It's that, I mean, I think you're basically right. Like it seems kind of arbitrary so far, which of the old X-Men stuff they're taking with them. And they also are kind of just rushing the development of the characters, you know, like you say, acting like they've been around for 20 years.
And that weirdly is a lesser complaint, because that's just 70s comics as opposed to like 90s comics.
Well, actually, a side thing. I was rewatching Star Wars.
I've heard of it.
6 months ago. Oh, you got to check it out. You'd really love it.
Yeah.
We had War Games last episode. Now Star Wars, really modernizing this podcast. But I hadn't seen it in a while. I love that movie. It was just,
we're talking the first Star Wars movie.
The very first New Hope, 1977 Star Wars.
Movie, episode 4.
That's right. I was on Disney Plus. I was watching like WandaVision or something, and Star Wars was sort of, I was like, oh, I could just watch Star Wars right now. And I watched it. And which, by the way, when I was a kid, to have access to just all the Star Wars movies on my, at a touch of a fingertip, would just be incredible. Like that would be the thing as a child I'd be most excited about the future. I'd be like, wait a minute, I get to have access to all those Star Wars movies?
It is both awesome and also sort of freezing. Like sometimes I'm like, oh, I should watch this movie again. It's like, oh, there's too many choices. I won't watch anything.
Yeah, so I totally agree.
I sometimes go the wrong way with it.
But it's really funny how quickly the main characters of Star Wars become emotionally attached. Like we see Luke Skywalker discovers his Aunt Beru and his Uncle Owen as skeletons, like a kind of a grisly scene, you know, killed by the Empire. And he's sad, but he's kind of stone-faced about it. And that makes his resolve that he has to leave the planet and go with Ben, right? That really makes him start the adventure.
Mm-hmm.
Then Ben gets killed by Darth Vader in the duel. And he is way more distraught. But I'm like, you've known this guy for one day.
Yeah.
And you saw the people who raised you burnt to a crisp. And you were mostly okay with it. Like, mostly pretty chill. Like, Even if you didn't like them and you resented them for holding you back, but it also seemed like he got along with them well. It wasn't like they were like Harry Potter's muggle parents or something.
That certainly is true. But it's also like some of that is helped by like acting, right? Like you got to see
Alec Guinness
charming, and Mark Hamill.
Yeah.
Like Bond. And you got to see these two actors absolutely have chemistry together.
It never bumped me before in my many viewings. I was just like, it is weird that he's known. And like Leia is like immediate, like Leia knows them for less than a day, like an afternoon. And they're like best friends hugging each other and stuff.
Like I'm rereading the Roger Stern era Spider-Man comics and also the Bill Mantlo Spectacular Spider-Man comics that were done at the same time. And in Spectacular, he falls in love with the Black Cat. And it happens like in a panel. it's like the Black Cat sort of makes flirts with him and he's like, oh, she's attractive. This is sort of interesting. I think I'm in love with her. And then like by the next panel, he's like, you dare threaten the woman I love. And it's like, whoa, 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 dude.
Yeah, whoa.
What it's our love? First date, basically. Yeah. She feels the same way about it. And that feels too much too fast. And I'm like, oh, I don't buy this relationship.
But am I right that like none of this bumped me when I was a kid? Like I never remember thinking, oh, this is happening too fast.
Well, I didn't read these comics.
Okay.
As a kid. So I don't actually know. I do think like, look at those Ditko Spider-Man comics with him and Betty Brant. He wasn't like madly in love with her immediately. Yeah. He just sort of asked her out and they went out for a while and then he liked her and he cared about her, but he would also like ask out Liz Allen when she wasn't around.
Yeah.
So it never felt like he was magically instantly in love with her. He sort of asked her out because she was sort of his age and around and he was a different person at the Bugle.
Yeah. He was like an adult at the Bugle.
And even like Reed and Sue, like their relationship, I mean, they get married pretty quick and have a kid pretty quick, but it's all on the page. Like we see them together for a long time. We see like Reed jealous of her with Namor. It wasn't just like issue one, he's meeting her and falling in love with her at the same time.
Well, Ditko was great. Also, we have to remember these issues would come out a month apart. So
2 months at this point, these X-Men are 2 months apart.
So like that in a way, even though Storm and if you're reading every month, it's been 2 months that Stormin has been in your mind.
Yeah. Though so like, there is also the aspect of some of these issues lead right into the next one. So it's not like that much time has passed for them. Like there is,
but I'm saying gaps for the reader, at some point. For the reader's relationship to the characters has had 2 months to grow. So like that might help them accelerate the in continuity relationship. What I was going to say about like stuff like what you're saying, like bringing back the Sentinels is kind of a weird choice and they're a weaker version. I don't have any argument of why that particular decision is good, but just in general, I do kind of like it when comic books feel a bit slapdash and improvised. I like it when they don't feel too labored. Like when I feel like the writer and the artist are just trying stuff and some stuff's going to work and some stuff isn't. Like the movies, you know, there's so much money at stake, so many cooks in the kitchen. I do enjoy them, but they feel rigid in a way.
Sure.
And the comics feel nicely fluid. So ironically, when there's something dumb, it kind of makes me feel like, oh, it's human. In a weird way, the mistakes of Marvel Comics make them fun as much as their good decisions. And I like that.
I mean, look, the Sentinels are great without question. And Juggernaut is so cool.
Yeah.
Like, why wouldn't you want to bring in Magneto when he comes back? You want these guys in the X-Men books. I don't know how they read. I've never read the Jack Kirby era stuff or whatever.
We'll do it next.
Whoever followed him. So I've never read the original run of the X-Men other than I think issue one.
Yeah.
But it's like, for whatever it is, like the Sentinels and Juggernaut look cool. Definitely bring them back. I'm just saying, don't bring back Eric the Red. Don't bring back Count Nefaria.
Yeah. It's kind of a weird start.
At least invent a new Count Nefaria. I mean, unless I think that was maybe that was Len Wein and he just loved that character. I don't
know.
Could
be, yeah.
And maybe this is Claremont putting his stamp. Now he's bringing in the characters he liked and he's got better taste. There's a chance that we'll see where it goes from there. Those are my only two really big complaints, though. It feels weird to reboot this series, treat these characters like longstanding X-Men, and then also like retread old X-Men stuff. Where it's like, I established these guys. I have that complaint with movies sometimes where it's like your hero gets the powers and then he goes up against his arch nemesis next scene. And I'm like, oh, you went right from getting bit by a spider to fighting the Green Goblin. I want to see you catch more muggers.
TV is better for comic book adaptations than movies for that reason.
And just character development in general.
Yeah.
But comics have that advantage, right?
Movies are bad. Movies are bad.
That's why Star Wars is bad and no one likes it.
That's why Star Wars did not work and nobody watched it.
If it was a TV series, you would have had seasons of Luke and Obi-Wan bonding before you sliced him in half.
Montage of them like shooting wombats down in Beggar's Canyon.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Or whatever it was. I don't remember what they shot in Beggar's Canyon. But so what generally happens here? This is the new X-Men. Professor X is going on vacation. The Sentinels invade.
Yeah, it starts at Christmas.
We see Jack and Stan at one point.
Yeah, we see a bunch of cameos.
Oh, I didn't. Are there more besides that?
On the first page, there's Nick Fury and Matt Murdock.
Oh, that's fun.
On the next page is Superman and Lois Lane.
What? I didn't see Superman and Lois Lane.
On the second page, just they're in the corner. They're walking out of frame.
I don't see this.
And then, yeah, then Jack and Stan.
Oh, my gosh, you're right.
It's
Clark Kent and Lois Lane.
Yeah, it's unquestionably them.
Oh, it's so fun.
I mean, there might be other people, too, that I'm not recognizing.
This is issue 98 we're talking about. The title is Merry Christmas, X-Men. I kind of love it when they play up the New York part of Marvel Comics. I love it. Like when because they're going to Rockefeller Center and looking at the tree and there's the ice skaters.
Also, I think on the ice is Dr. Doom.
Oh, you're
all
right.
All the way on the right.
Yes,
Or at least it looks like him. I mean, that might just be.
Dr. Doom ice skating. That is genius. That's better than those wondrous sentinels. We got to see like ice skating Dr. Doom.
So yeah, it's filled with cameos. In a weird way, this issue, despite the fact that it doesn't introduce the characters, feels like this is the new X-Men.
Right.
It feels like such a fresh start here. Part of that is maybe affected because Marvel's very recently, and Busiek and Ross did like a Marvel's 8-page addition to their book. And it was tied into this.
Oh, really?
I've never read this issue, but I've read this Marvel's adaption of it. And of course it is great.
That's so fun. Well, we see there's on page two, we see,
and we're not going to go page by page.
We're not going page by page, but just like, this is a fun moment. Jean Grey and Scott Summers kiss. And they are a couple, but they have this kind of passionate kiss. Because she's kind of just overwhelmed with the romance of the situation. And Stan Lee and Jack Kirby are behind them. And Jack says, "Hey, Stan, you know who they were? I tell you, they never used to do that when we had the book." And Stan goes, "Ah, Jack, you know, these young kids, they got no respect." First of all, I'm always a fan of the forced meta appearances of Stan Lee in the Marvel books and Jack Kirby. They're corny. They're dumb. I love them. But they are making a statement here, which is like, we're going to be doing things differently with these new X-Men. And I got excited for it. I'm like, yeah, let's have romance. Let's have love. Let's have the people. I mean, the X-Men is young passion. Like, I think that's what they've got that the other Marvel books don't have.
I generally don't love meta stuff, but I didn't mind. For some reason, maybe because it's an old comic, I'm like, oh, this is fun. Also, because they included Jack. It wasn't just Stan.
They included Jack. Yeah.
Claremont and Cockrum know what they're doing.
They know what they're doing. Plus, you know, at this time, this is the late 70s. Jack and Stan are working at Marvel again. They're probably doing Silver Surfer around this time.
It's also the captions are very fun throughout. And this page is just a good example of it where Jean and
Scott
are attacked by Sentinels and Jean screams, "It can't be them, not them." And then the caption goes, "But it is."
Yes, it's very fun. You know, it's funny. I associate with Chris Claremont first and foremost teen pathos and drama and like soap opera stuff. But the action is good in these stories. Like the fighting is really fun.
Oh, I always think of him as subplots and catchphrases.
Oh, catchphrases? Really?
Yeah. Like I'm the best there is at what I do or whatever it is. But what I do isn't very nice. Fastball special. Like people kind of saying the same things a fair amount.
Oh, I've never
that and like seeding a plot way in advance.
Okay.
He's not the only one who does those things, but like those two sort of things.
Yeah. I associate that with Claremont, like a million plots. There's like a million things in the air at all times.
Like the comics we talked about last, Mutants and Mailbags, and this one all have Professor X having these like nightmares of aliens. That doesn't happen.
Right. That is just teased for like 10 issues.
And this is like 6 or 7 issues where that has not happened. That is a year because this is a bi-monthly comic. That is a year.
Yeah.
That it's been like, what is this about? We're not getting to it anytime soon, it seems like. And I don't have a problem with that. I think it's fun.
Do you know what Claremont does in these issues? And this might be something that lots of people do, but I really love, is he's really big on the in a battle, one of the X-Men, they do half a sentence before they strike, and then they strike, finishing their sentence in a huge bold-faced balloon. Like Nightcrawler will say something like, you know, you may think that I'm making this up, but you may think that I'm small, so I don't pack a punch, but now you shall feel the Nightcrawler's wrath.
Yeah. And classic like, Nightcrawler line.
Boom or whatever. I know that's not good Nightcrawler dialogue, but like, but that sort of cadence of like the big punch with the sort of dramatic declaration,
yeah.
You know, you shall not let Colossus die or whatever.
Yeah, I'm not sure how many of these things Claremont's doing he was the first to do. I bet almost none of them. He just does them all really well.
Yeah.
Because obviously subplots is not a Claremont thing, but he's really good at handling them. Like he's seeded this storm being uncomfortable and claustrophobic without really, there's not like a word balloon where she goes, I'm claustrophobic. But even the last batch of issues we talked about, there was a couple moments where she got like a little anxious.
Yeah.
And in this five issues, like she's in a stone castle and she starts freaking out. Completely. And then she falls into like a dungeon and shuts down.
Another thing. Yes. And it's very it's exciting. Like Storm is their big firepower superpower. Yeah. And she's taken out of the battle by her claustrophobia.
But as opposed to the things I'm complaining about, that feels like so earned. It's not like, oh, she's claustrophobic. Where did this come from?
Yeah, they were planting
those seeds. Or it didn't feel like so overtly just thrown in for no reason early. It wasn't like she went into the bathroom and was like, oh, better be careful, my claustrophobia.
I think Claremont's doing a good, the reason I like the action is he's doing a good reason. He does the good thing that comics do of just like, okay, these are your powers. Here's a situation in which there's not an obvious solution for you to win. Mm-hmm. Like at one point, the villain, what's his name? The bad guy in this little series?
Tom or
the no, before senator. Black Tom, the senator.
Senator Lang.
Senator Lang gets them all in space.
Or something Lang.
Something Lang. They're all in space.
Yeah,
like Banshee, Storm, Colossus, and like, yeah, what are the without gravity and land, they are kind of, and Storm can't do weather stuff.
Yeah.
She's not sure if she can.
Yeah.
So that's like just kind of a fun little predicament, superhero, superpower wise.
Here's another thing I'll say. I didn't realize Phoenix was this early.
Phoenix happens so early.
Like Phoenix is born in these issues. Her new costume is phenomenal. Great job, Dave Cockrum.
Dave Cockrum,
she's so much better than the Marvel Girl costume. Such an upgrade.
All of who are the characters that Dave Cockrum did the visual design for? Nightcrawler, Colossus, Storm, right?
Yep. Yeah, and Phoenix.
And Phoenix. And did he revamp Wolverine? He hasn't yet, so not yet.
I don't think so. Not. I mean, a little bit. He tweaked Wolverine.
He's only tweaked Wolverine, so we can't give him Wolverine.
But those guys are great. He also designs the who we haven't met yet, but the I think maybe the Starjammers, but what are the guys in space?
I don't know.
I don't know their names. We'll get to them eventually. We'll get to them. But I heard like he had made these designs for the Legion of Superheroes and then didn't end up using them. And so just sort of created characters to like use these designs he had come up with. Anyway, when we get to them, I'll talk about that again. And people will email us now and say, like, Kevin, those names are so obvious. You should know. Gladiator is one of them. Remember, you know Gladiator because he was in the FF comics.
Yep. I do remember that.
So he designs a lot of those guys, and they look great. Anyway, he's a great designer, and there's no question about it. Like, when Juggernaut showed up, I didn't remember for sure if Juggernaut had been a previously existing character. I had to look it up real quick.
Yeah.
Because I've never read the previous Juggernaut stories. And I was like, oh, Dave Cockrum designed Juggernaut too, probably, which he didn't. Kirby did. But it's like another great designer.
Yeah, Kirby's not so bad on that visual design either.
Anyway, yeah, these characters look phenomenal. Phoenix looks phenomenal. The thing that hits me when I'm reading the Phoenix birth is obviously I know what happens to her. I've read the issues where she dies.
Yeah.
Then she comes back like now she comes back like when I was reading a ton of comics.
Yeah. So I remember there because that happened that the FF are somewhat involved.
The FF and maybe the Avengers too. And X-Factor. Obviously,
that was one of the first big undoing of deaths in Marvel. Like now it's kind of commonplace, but like that was like controversial to bring.
Do you know who came up with the idea to bring her back?
No.
Kurt Busiek.
Oh, really? As a youngin.
I mean, an adult. But a young adult, yes. I think he pitched it
new in his time at Marvel, I think.
Yeah, I don't think he had written comics yet. He may have been like an intern somewhere, but I think he pitched it to Roger Stern or somebody. He's like, hey, if you ever want to bring this character back, I kind of know how you could do it. And the way they bring her back, like reading this issue, knowing how she comes back. And I think a lot of people say, oh, well, they should have never brought her back.
Right.
It hurts the character to have her come back, even though there's been good stories with her, blah, blah, blah. But I will say, like, the way she goes underwater and then comes out in a new costume, like his tweak of it was just that that's somebody else coming out of the water. That's this alien entity that has absorbed Phoenix, Jean Grey's, like a personality and looks and appearance, like a body snatcher type situation.
Yeah.
And left the real Jean Grey, like in a stasis thing under the bottom of the river.
Okay.
And it's taken her place, but it doesn't know it's not her.
Right.
It's like, it's confused because of things like that makes, when I read this, I'm like, oh yeah, it feels like that. It feels like a new character, like she died and a new character was born.
Yeah.
So the reason he did it that way is so that old Jean Grey is not responsible for killing a planet.
And it's okay to bring her back morally.
It's okay to bring her back and not put her in jail forever. Anyway, like I'm reading this like, oh, Kurt was right. It fits perfectly. It does not cause a wrinkle in this story.
But you are right that it happens so early. It's an issue 101. Like the new X-Men are 94, and 7 issues later, we replace Marvel. But why not? We're in an era of rebooting. At this point, these characters are not that important to the Marvel universe. They soon will be. But like, I mean, you have leverage to kind of go nuts.
I mean, Marvel Girl is a bad name.
It's so weird to name a girl after the company that you're part of. That's just strange. It would be like having here's a new movie starring MGM Joe. It's like MGM Joe.
I mean, it is sort of weird to have like Miss Marvel and Captain Marvel also as members of the Marvel universe, right?
That's
like,
all weird.
Especially now when they're like Marvel's Captain Marvel. That's what they call the movies. And it's like, that's weird, right?
It's weird. It's dumb. Yeah.
Even though Captain Marvel's a cool name. Unquestionably.
Yes.
Though it makes me think of the Shazam Captain Marvel first.
That's another reason why it's weird. It's already kind of been used by this very like.
Yeah, they grabbed it just because it
has. Prominent character.
I mean, calling their company Marvel when there was a prominent Captain Marvel is weird.
Yeah.
It would be like if.
Superman comics.
We don't have Superman.
Oh, yeah. He's somebody else.
Oh, well, we wish we had Superman. Anyway, read Superman, Spider-Man. it's very weird. It's very weird to do that. But Phoenix is cool. Phoenix is a much improved.
She's so compelling right away. Like her power is immense. She seems out of control almost immediately.
Even if you don't give her like what we know is coming with like this cosmic side of her and all that other stuff, even if this is it. I'm like, this is a huge improvement. This is a way better character. I'm so interested in this character. And even the fact that she's been reborn is sort of an interesting thing that she's dealing with, that she died and is alive again. Anyway, these 5 issues are great. The Birth of Phoenix, the Sentinels, the Sentinels is like 3 issues and it does like an FF Kirby style. Halfway through the next issue, it turns into the Leprechaun plot. And the Leprechauns are silly. But Juggernaut is great.
Claremont loves Ireland, I guess, because he just introduces Ireland as a huge, huge like stage for a lot of the X-Men stories.
Well, he's got Banshee, right?
Yeah. Banshee's Irish.
Yeah.
But we're not going to Canada. We got Wolverine too. You know what I mean? Like it's
not going to Canada now. I don't know what happens in this run. But yeah, probably.
So here's one of my favorite moments in this book. In issue 102. This is a little bit later in the story. They've defeated Senator Lang and his like fake X robots and his lesser sentinels, but now they're in a castle in Ireland and they're in a fight with a juggernaut.
And this is where the X-Men are forced to take a vacation. There's been 2 vacation plots in a very short span in the X-Men. These guys just relax too much is all I'm saying.
They're Bernie bros. They want social, they want a lot of benefits. They want healthcare and they want paid vacation.
Boy.
So they're in this castle. They're fighting Juggernaut. This is in issue 102. I don't know what page, but Colossus and Wolverine are fighting because Wolverine keeps calling Colossus Rusky.
Yeah, yeah.
And Wolverine has just used Colossus has thrown him like a battering ram at Juggernaut.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so Colossus is more mad that he got called Rusky. So Colossus says, do not call me that. And do not come between me and my friends again, Wolverine, or by all I hold dear. That's right. Colossus was protecting Storm, who's collapsed in claustrophobia. Wolverine's like, no, we need you to fight Juggernaut. Colossus won't do it, so Wolverine picks him up and throws him into Juggernaut, calls him Rusky. Then Colossus says what I just said. Do not call me that. Do not come between me and my friends, Wolverine, or by all I hold dear. And then Wolverine says, well, I'll be. Peter Pureheart finally gets a mad on. All right, bub, all you got to do is pick the time and place. And then Juggernaut says, here, fools, and now. He's answering the time. And so then Wolverine instantly is protecting Colossus. Colossus, look out. Like that, I love they fight with each other, but when there's a common enemy, they protect each other.
So they're having a fight while fighting the common enemy. Maybe pick your battles.
But it
is a great sequence.
I love that about the X-Men. They love each other. Like the friendship as a kid, and I think you relate to the idea that when you have true friends, you'll stand together and protect each other to the ends of the earth. It's like extremely compelling part that the X-Men have better than most Marvel titles, I think.
Yeah. Again, it makes it feel like they've been a team for a lot longer than they probably have.
But it's fun.
There's been one montage in the Danger Room, and now they will die to protect each other. There was also like a weird thing where it felt like they were trying to set Colossus and Storm up as a couple, and that seems to get subdued during this Leprechaun arc, and I'm glad.
Yeah.
I just don't need everyone to pair off so fast.
We get Storm's origin, which is kind of nice. We find out Storm's origin story.
Her origin's really layered and cool. I guess she was born in America. I didn't know that.
She's an American, but her mom's from Kenya, and they go kind of like Obama. She's got a parent from Kenya.
Wait, oh my goodness. Well, you're picking the wrong signs.
Well, I just don't believe that Obama's American. No, I'm like kidding. I do believe that Obama's American, but no, but it's true. Like she's got a Kenyan-born parent, just like Obama. Mm-hmm. She and her parents and her dad is an American, and she's born in Harlem. And then, her parents go back to America when she's a little toddler and they're killed.
Yeah.
And she's orphaned and then raised as kind of a street thief in the streets of Cairo.
Yep. And then she becomes a goddess.
Then she becomes a goddess who can control the weather and in Kenya, right?
Yeah.
I don't know where she goes. She wanders across the desert by herself.
Yeah. As like a preteen.
I mean, it is fast, but it is layered, and it's just like Dr. Doom's origin.
Yeah.
Made him like 10 times more interesting. And Storm was already cool, whereas Doom was insane. Storm's origin also, it's like, oh, I can unpack this for like 12 issues all by itself.
You could do a 12 issue maxi series just of Storm pre-powers, and it would be very good. It would be a great story.
And so I think like the reboot, you know, Marvel Girl into Phoenix, adding Storm's origin, we're starting to see some huge moves that presage how cool this run is going to be.
I mean, Storm does take a shower in a castle room by creating rain, and I wonder who cleaned that up. That seems rude. She was not in a shower stall when she did that. But otherwise, yes, Storm is great. They also do a fun thing with the image inducer. Like Nightcrawler, he has this like little hologram thing that makes him look like anyone, and he plays with it early in this arc to look like all these celebrities. But it becomes a plot point in the second half of the story where he impersonates Professor X. And it's like, and that's stuff that's really cool, where it's like, oh, it's played for like a joke, and it's like, here's this fun little amazing piece of technology. But then it's like, oh, they're doing that for a reason. Like that is,
they're introducing the tool to you, so you know about it later. It's earned when it's used later.
Yeah, when he did it, I'm like, oh, right. He can change shape whenever he wants in a weird way. It's an amazing piece of technology. Comics are always that, especially this era of comics, this and older comics, where like they'll have things like that where like someone has invented a device that can make Nightcrawler look like anybody and anything completely convincingly, but it's really hard for them to get to and from space. And I love that. I love it being like, oh, that's not just an easy, like nowadays, I feel like if the X-Men were up in a space station, they would call one of the 50 superhero teams to come up in their Quinjets to come get them.
Right. But that it's like a whole issue for them to get back to Earth here.
Or like there's a moment where Professor X is like, you got to get to Ireland and help the X-Men. And Cyclops is like, I won't get there in time.
Yeah. Cyclops is standing by Jean Grey's side. She's come back as Phoenix. She's still recovering from her wounds. And yeah, Cyclops is like, I can't help. Like they are in another country.
It would take him like 12 hours to get there.
Yeah.
If they're still fighting in 12 hours, they're winning probably.
Yeah. It's going to be decided. And he's like, this is, they have to earn their medal on their own. That was cool too.
It was overplayed a little bit. Professor X gets so mad about it. And I'm sure like, Cyclops is making good sense. I don't know, dude. Relax. Yeah. Relax, Professor. Anyway, we should wrap up. Any last thoughts on these six issues, Will?
I'm so excited. I'm so glad we're doing it. I can't wait to read more X-Men.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the first five issues, but these six issues feel like
we've taken
another level.
Yeah.
Quickly, just another strong step forward. It's like, these feel great. The first five were fun, but these are great comics already. Like, these are comics I can imagine. Like, those first five I can imagine reading being like, I don't know if I'll keep reading this. These are good, though. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Depends on what else I'm getting. And I read these six. It's like, oh, yeah, I would definitely want to keep reading this.
I can't wait to see what happens. Like, I'm so excited.
We'll talk about another five or so issues next time we do mail, Will.
All right. Next time we do Mutants and Mailbag.
Let's take a break.
Let's break.
Oh, we both said it.
Yay.
Star Wars.
Star Wars. That's what we say when we say something at the same time.
Our version of Jinx.
Star Wars. Owe me a force.
Hi, this is Kevin. I'm here with my brother, Will, and we are the hosts of Screw It. We're just going to talk about comics, our weekly podcast about comic books.
And we want to hear from you. We have a slew of social media accounts, a slew.
You can email us at screwitcomics@gmail.com or see us on Instagram at @screwitcomics or tweet at us at @screwitcomics.
So tell us what you think of the comics you like or the comics you don't or things we've talked about on our episodes.
Or send us some life advice. You can tell that we need it.
Yes.
We might read your message on a future episode of our show.
So thanks. In advance from Screw It, we're just going to talk about comics from Campfire Media.
And we're back. We're going to read some mail. If you want to mail us, how would they do that, Will?
I have no idea.
All right. Well, you can't mail us.
We have our email address is screwitcomics@gmail. Please email us. Tell us what you think of The Mutants or Superior Spider-Man or any comics that you're reading. Requests for us to cover stuff. Casting questions, which we will not be able to answer well. Yeah. Anything you'd like, please email us at screwitcomics@gmail. We also have a Twitter account, Screw It Comics, and an Instagram account, Screw It Comics, where Kevin does a really great job of putting up screenshots of the things we're talking about. So please get in touch with us. We are lonely and ready to talk to you.
All right. So we got a bunch of emails. Let's see how many we can get through today. This one's from Megan from late April. So we're catching up to current days.
We're recording this at the end of May. So Yeah.
We're like a month behind.
Not bad.
Though I'm reading sort of out of order. I'm not necessarily just reading the old ones.
Now I don't know what to believe.
Okay. Well, enjoying the season of interviews. After your interview with Jeff Smith, I went to my local comic store, House of Heroes, and picked up the first collection of Bone and Batman Year One. I even got my husband to read both. It was fun to read a non-superhero comic. Looking forward to letting my son read Bone in the future.
Yeah.
Batman Year One was the best. I cried when the baby was falling off the bridge. That was the scariest part for me, even though it all ended well. The art is so beautiful in that book. So glad you guys talked about it. My husband was into it, and I kept bringing up how I wish we had more Gordon, less Batman. I like this Megan person.
They're playing right into your hands.
Bone and Batman Year One, it's hard to get better comics than those two things.
Thank you. So I can't think of a better compliment than somebody trying out a comic after we talk about it. You know, that
it really is. I mean,
that feels so good. I understand if people don't have the bandwidth to try out the stuff we recommend, but thank you so much, Megan, for doing that. That makes me feel great.
But it's also good when someone tries out the best ones. That helps. Oh, yeah. That helps our success rate.
It makes us look good if somebody's like, well, I'll give Year One and Bone a shot. I'm like, oh, well, you're going to love it. Like,
I'm going to try Fantastic Four 99.
Oops.
and the Hulk with the Hulk where he goes underground. Those are the two I'll try.
It's like, uh-oh. But as we said in those episodes, those comics are so beautiful. And the baby falling is something that as a teenager is just like, it's like kind of run-of-the-mill stakes.
Yeah.
But then when you're an adult and you've seen how, you know, like basically Kevin, you having a child and like there's a baby in your life that it means everything to you. Even the fictional prospect of a baby getting hurt is like, oh my God, if this baby is hurt, I don't even know if I'll be able to finish the comic.
Yeah, it is. Sometimes those things are really hard for me to watch or enjoy because I get too anxious about it. But yeah, that moment is terrifying. Like, it's like, oh, Gordon's chasing after, he's going to save the baby. And now it's like, he's got this. Oh my God, this is the most important thing in the world. He's got to do it.
Yeah.
When Batman saves his child, I'm like, well,
their friendship is forever solidified. Yeah, like that's it. It's such a smart move also to, why would Gordon go so, this law abiding by the book cop.
Yeah.
Go so out of it. It's like, hey, this, he just saved his son's life. Like, automatically, there's going to be some amount of latitude given to this person.
And theoretically risked his own life to do it.
Yeah.
Megan goes on, I would love to hear your thoughts on WandaVision and the Falcon and Winter Soldier. Both kept my eyes glued to the screen. Do you guys think after Loki and Hawkeye come out, you'll do a recap on the shows? Impressed with all your interviews this season, Megan. We're not going to do recaps. That's not, I mean, I don't think so. We're going to be too busy talking about War Games and Star Wars.
We got a lot of other irrelevant stuff to keep being obsessed with.
But I loved both of them.
I haven't seen Falcon the Winter Soldier, but I loved WandaVision, and I loved that everybody got excited about it. Like, it's so fun when a comics property kind of gets the attention of all of my friends, I guess. Like, just a lot of people I knew were watching WandaVision as it came out and talking about it. That was really exciting.
I mean, I'm a huge fan of not binging where they drop shows one. I get why people want binged, but it's like, drop one a week so that people, if it's good, people will watch it and talk about it. Oh, it's the best.
I really loved it. I thought, I thought it was really enjoyable. I have some friends who felt that WandaVision kind of was a little too neatly pat, that they kind of like the initial episodes where everything's really strange and they're caught in the sitcom world. They thought that the solution to that puzzle was a little too simplified. I don't agree. I thought it was the right amount of like meta and explained. I thought it was really satisfying.
Yeah. I mean, I got anxious when it was announced that it was going to be too much of like just the parody stuff. And I'm like, I'm going to get bored of this, aren't I? And like, there's less and less of that each episode, basically.
Yeah. I thought it was well done.
I'm also a huge fan of Monica Rambeau in the comics. So I'm excited to see that character, also known as Captain Marvel for a while.
Yep.
Now largely called Photon or Spectrum, sort of start coming into her own. Randall Park is really great. It's just fun. It's got like just the right amount of like connective tissue. And Vision's great. This is probably the best Vision in all the MCU. Like, Vision's not that fun in the movies. He's okay. He's got a cool power set. He's got, you know, Paul Bettany is phenomenal.
Incredible. Yeah.
But in this, you get to really see him do like, both he's fun in the early episodes as being Paul Bettany, and in the last couple episodes where he's full on Vision and doing battle sequences, it's like, it's great. It was great to see the Vision.
And of course, Scarlet Witch is great in this and her backstory with the sale.
The star of the character.
Yeah. So I can't wait to watch Falcon and Winter Soldier. I've gotten caught up with a couple of the shows right now, but I'm
Falcon and Winter Soldier, no spoilers because Will hasn't watched it. Everyone listening, don't spoil it. but I think it's more by the numbers. It's more just like
more standard fare.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good. It's really, I really, really enjoyed it, but it is less of a, like, this is sort of like, what's going on? Oh, this is cool. This is a little different. It's not drastically rewriting how you tell television or anything, but like WandaVision is like, it doesn't feel like a typical MCU movie where Falcon and Winter Soldier sort of feels like a good Captain
what you
America
might expect
movie.
For an MCU TV show.
Yes.
That's enough for me. That's enough for me to watch it. So,
I mean, Anthony Mackie is great. And I think about how great it is that they cast him so long ago as Falcon and like,
yeah.
And now he's sort of like Captain America. And it's just like, oh, you guys picked the right guy right out of the gate. And what a great actor to have, like, to said, like, we're keeping this guy around for a while.
Yeah.
Great for him. He's making money and he's getting more famous. So he's going to get to do more of what he wants, but also great for Marvel just to have a guy who can do it.
Yeah. I'm excited. I can't wait to watch it.
And I'm really looking forward to Loki. I think that's going to be a blast.
Never heard of him.
All right. Fair enough. Here's an email we just got from...
So out of order. Now I just don't know what's happening.
This is from Mark David Christensen, host of Aw Crap, Hellboy podcast.
Yeah, we've been on that. Former guest. Oh, no, we've been on that.
And he's been on ours. It was a shared...
Oh, yeah.
It was a back and forth type situation. He just wants to... Have you heard about this? Well, he wants to ask your thoughts on this wild casting. Aaron Taylor Johnson is Kraven the Hunter. Have you heard about this?
No, I haven't.
They've announced a Kraven the Hunter solo movie.
From Sony. Wow.
Starring Aaron Taylor Johnson, who I don't really know. He played Quicksilver in the Marvel Universe movies. He dies in
What are the Avengers?
Avengers 2.
Okay.
He is both introduced and dies in Avengers 2. So I don't know the actor that well. So whenever I hear casting, I'm always like, I'm sure they'd be good. Mm-hmm. My assumption is always anyone will be good in the role. Like they're good at, they're actors. They've auditioned. Like, I'm sure like they're, you know, auditioning someone who they think can pull this off.
Yeah.
Even if they've never played something like this before, I sort of believe in them until I see them fail.
To me, the more interesting part of that is a solo Kraven movie. That's the part that I'm interested
in. Yeah, that sounds dumb to me. And just in the sense of like, I don't know what that character is as a solo character.
Well, I know what you're saying. Like Kraven is one of those ridiculous Ditko characters with his big potions and his like, you know, hunting animals. And
sure.
Stuff.
Yeah.
But a movie gives you enough room to like make the character whatever you need it to be. Like,
right.
It could
but
be.
But once you do that, it's just the name.
Yeah.
Like, is this the same Kraven that I see fighting Spider-Man? It doesn't feel like it. Once you remove Spider-Man from it.
I guess I just mean like, I don't know what to think until I see it. Like there'll be room for this to be really good or room for it to be kind of okay, bad, which is what I would call Venom. I don't know. So I'm sure. Excited to see it.
If it gets made, you never know with these things. But yeah, my main complaint about it is like, I was really looking forward to see Kraven in a Spider-Man movie.
I see.
Yeah. And now I won't for a while. He's the only member of the original Sinister Six not to be a live action version yet.
Oh, well, I'm excited to see it.
So I wish she was there. But
the casting that I'm excited about is Sandman TV series has announced its casting.
Yeah.
And the woman who's cast as Death, Kirby Howell Baptiste, is a friend of mine. She's a student from the UCB LA. I mean, she's a successful actor who's going to be in the Cruella de Vil movie, and she's done a lot of stuff.
She's mostly known as a friend of yours.
But I think primarily she's known as someone who took a 4-week class from Will Hines in 2014 and did improv with him in London once. Me, Joel Spence, Connor Ratliff, and Kirby did a set with the C3 improv group. I think that's her primary credit before this.
Yeah, that sounds right.
And but she's really funny and really great. And she's got cast as Death, which I think, I mean, no exaggeration, is one of the greatest characters in comics that I've ever read. And so for them,
possibly the best character in the Sandman universe.
Definitely a contender for it. You could argue that it's better than Dream for sure.
I think for sure it's better than Dream. Not as big a role, but it's more likely to be the breakout character that everyone loves and wants to see more of.
Yeah. And so I'm just excited for the Sandman TV series. I'm excited for whatever they do with it. I listened to the audiobook adaptation and it was really fun. And that I know somebody who I also know is great. Like it's like Kate McKinnon got SNL. It's like everybody who knew Kate from UCB was like, yeah, duh. Like she's going to be incredible. And she was.
I don't know. Kirby. I didn't know she was your friend. I haven't looked at her IMDb page about
who
her friends were.
She's primarily known as my friend. I mean, I haven't talked to her or emailed her in like 3 years, but I feel like we're very close.
But she was on Killing Eve, at least the first season, the only season I watched. And she was really good in like a very small role.
Yeah.
And like, she was one of those people that's like, something about this actor just like pops off the screen in this tiny role. And then she showed up in The Good Place. I was like, it's her again. This is very exciting. She's great.
Yeah.
And then I saw she was Death. And I'm like, oh, good for her. But if I knew she was your friend, I'd be like, of course. They're going to.
This is really inside baseball, but she was in a two-prov indie, two-prov group with Natalie Palomitas. I think they were called Two Hot Dogs. And Natalie has become like a breakout star with her one-person shows, Nate. And what was her egg show? She had a show where she was an egg. but she was it won all these awards at the Edinburgh Fringe Fest. And now Nate is a Netflix special that Amy Poehler produced. And it's incredible. And she's like a phenomenon on her own. But like when it was Kirby and Natalie as Two Hot Dogs, they would like be doing an improv set like 11 p.m. at the Clubhouse in L.A., like this black box theater. Fun, but it was like it was almost like a silly idea. I think they would dress up as hot dogs and do improv.
Yeah.
And it'd be like, well, this is who cares? Like, oh, this is like a frivolous little throwaway thing from two good people, but it's like, you're watching two of the biggest stars of the next 5 years.
It used to be funny that way. If you could go back in time and see what some of these really funny, famous people did, just be like,
Aubrey Plaza in their three-prov group, Frankenstein's Eyes, where her and Violet and I think Marcy Giroux would come out and just like pretend to be they would make little gestures in front of their eyes, like big eyes coming out. They're like, we're Frankenstein's eyes. They'd be like, what does that mean?
Yeah. It's crazy to think of like the stupid things.
Yeah.
Talented people.
Yeah.
Did.
That's kind of fun.
Before they got successful. So yeah, maybe they'll do Frankenstein's eyes one more time. Dan Gillette emailed us. Well,
Danbury Hatter.
He emailed us because we were talking about Union Jack.
Yeah.
Let's see. He loved our interview with Chris Gethard and Jeff Smith. Those are the two people we bring up a lot. Those did great. He tried to plug us on the John Byrne's fan site, but John Byrne was too busy getting annoyed by somebody dogging Galactus. Okay. And you were talking about Union Jack and wondering if he'd had a great arc. And I'd say the run by Byrne and Stern, and that is awesome. This is the Captain America story. The collected trade War and Remembrance would probably be a great Cap run for all of you to explore as Byrne fans. Have you read it? It's my favorite Cap era, and the Britain Baron Blood stuff is the best. And that's where Union Jack comes in. It helped that I was a huge fan of the Invaders comics in the 70s. And then he has one more thing to say, which I'll read after we talk about Union Jack. We have read that. You had that trade, I think.
Yeah, sounds like it. I would buy a lot of John Byrne stuff back in the day.
Yeah. So I think you had a collection of this War and Remembrance, because I think that's how I read it. I can't say if it's the best Cap run just because I think it's one of the only Cap runs I've read.
Probably one of the only Brubaker. Cap runs. Yeah.
I have not read the Grunewald run, which is supposed to be epic.
Yeah. It's Gethard approved.
Yeah, that's right. He then goes on to say, I appreciate your take on Stan and Jack and Steve. I think it's appropriately nuanced. It doesn't fall into any specific camp. It's so obvious to me that Jack and Steve and Stan were all great talents. And like certain bands, they're better working together than apart. On that note, the Silver Surfer stuff is great and in no small part to the genius of brilliance of John Buscema. I think that Buscema isn't lauded enough these days for his contribution to Marvel. His ability to blend the dynamic and bombastic of Kirby with the handsome and beautiful faces of Romita and the anatomical brilliance of Adams is really incredible. His brother is no slouch either. That's true.
Sal?
Yeah. Yeah, Sal. Sal had a great run of Hulk and then a really great later era run on Spider-Man that I think his art is phenomenal.
I think Dan's totally right. That was put in so articulately. Because when I think of John Buscema, I picture like cosmic grand, like landscapes, but with very human looking people. Like it's closer to Neil Adams than anything else, but it's true. He's not become one of those. I mean, to Marvel fans, we all know John Buscema, but he's not one of the, like the household names the way like Kirby or Ditko is.
Or even like Steranko or.
Yeah. He like maybe wasn't quite signature style enough or flashy enough to stay. He was merely great. He was not maybe unique enough.
He should
something.
Be as big as like Romita, I would think, and Steranko, who didn't do that much.
But Romita is only really, I think, great because he did set that long run of Spider-Man, right? Like that, like established Romita in the Marvel mindset or whatever. Like,
yeah, and he did like the run that almost became like the style guide for the character.
Visually, yeah.
Yeah. Here is an email from Chuck. His subject is Milksop just wet bread? Is his subject header.
I'm intrigued.
But that's not what he talks about in here. I'm a big fan of the show and the comics you've covered. While I love the classic stuff, my first exposure to comic books was in the mid-90s through Marvel's, the Busiek Ross series, recontextualizing classic golden and silver age stories. The purity of those covers and the strength of the themes hooked me more than any of the more contemporary styles of the time. I loved how Marvel's grounded older stories by leaning into Busiek's use of civilian POV. Namor's attack on New York from a 40s comic was the most cinematic comic book I'd ever seen until literal actual comic book cinema became a thing. And even now it ranks pretty high on the list. I was wondering what you think of those kinds of stories, especially given Marvel's is making a comeback of sorts in the fairly recent history of the Marvel Universe large format book. Do you have any favorites? I love Marvel's. I think you do too.
I do. I love Marvel's. It was the arrival of Kurt Busiek, as far as I'm concerned. Like, I guess he had done stuff before, but that like established him as like a big, and Alex Ross, like,
yeah.
Maybe Alex had done a lot of stuff, but that like cemented them.
It made both of them superstars. Yeah. Those covers too. He bring up those covers. Like, that's why I think I picked up the first issue I picked up was like the cover. I don't remember if it was like the giant man stepping over the camera.
That's the one I think of.
I was like, oh, this looks good. I don't care what this is.
And you know, he brings up a good point that I hadn't appreciated, which was Marvel's is pre-superhero movies.
Yeah.
So like Alex Ross's art is great now, but like at that time, it was the closest you had to a sort of grand photographic view of what the Marvel characters might look like. And it was really striking. And it's true. It was the best. It was the most cinematic portrait of this universe we loved pre-movies.
Yeah, I remember there's a cover of Spider-Man on it. I'm sort of like, oh, he looks like a guy wearing a costume more than Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Both good and bad that kind of comes with that.
It kind of humbles them and humanizes them, but still looks kind of grand somehow.
Yeah, and it is very cool. I mean, that book is great. I bought the History of the Marvel Universe book that Mark Waid did and has beautiful art. I don't necessarily love the drier. That's more of a drier. Here's a almost a prose description of how the Marvel Universe's history. That stuff sort of bores me. I was never a handbook guy. But Marvel's is exactly in the right spot for me. Like, let's revisit these cool things and from a different angle.
That's the genius thing. Like, going from the civilian's point of view, there's a whole lot of like rebooting and revisiting classic Marvel stories. It's happened a million times, a million ways, but that's one of the all-time great ones.
Yeah.
And of course, it indicated what Astro City would be like, which is a lot of times from civilian points of view and is one of the best superhero series ever.
I mean, I think anybody who likes Marvel comics, Marvel's would not be the first thing I'd give you if you wanted to try a comic book, but it would probably be the second thing if you liked the first thing. Whatever it is you read first, it's like, well, then you're going to like this.
Yeah.
If you like the idea of comic books and superheroes, here it is. If you're already in.
Very rad.
So yes, Chuck, I love it. What do we got time-wise? We got time for a couple more.
Exciting.
Let's do it. This is one from, here's one from James. This is in May now, Will, so hold on to your hats. Howdy, milksops. I love the season of guests, and I'm looking forward to more interviews in the future. I'm writing because I wanted to know what issues of Superior Spider-Man are. I told him this. I also wanted to mention that I was recently reading a story by the excellent author Eudora Welty titled Moonlake. It's a story about a group of girls at a summer camp by a lake. And if you're at all familiar with Welty, you'll know that there's a lot of weirdness and subversion under that bland sounding premise. The reason I bring it up, however, is that in the story, she writes about how the girls swimming in their panty waists. It's the only time I've ever seen the word used to refer to an actual garment rather than as a childish insult. It's apparently a kind of play suit with a suit that buttons onto the bottoms. Anyway, I thought you'd want to know. I'll keep you informed if I run across any mention of milksops in my literary endeavors. And he's right. I did want to know.
He's right. I'm interested in that. He was right to tell us.
So panty waists are like underwear with snap bottoms.
So it's like a childish undergarment. So it's both undermining a man for being a feminine thing and also a childish thing.
Yeah, I love it. Here's an email from Steve. Hi there, fellow milksops. Wanted to write in and say that I'm really
fellow
excited.
Fellow milksops. He's identifying himself as a milksop.
Yeah, man. He gets it. He knows who he is. I wanted to write in and say that I'm really excited for your episodes on Superior Spider-Man. For me, it was the epitome of sounds bananas and awful when explained out loud, but it is awesome when you read it.
I agree that's with that.
True.
Yeah.
As I held off for years before actually giving it a go and loving it. I had mentioned once on Twitter that I read the Superior run while in the hospital after a second liver transplant, so it means a lot to me. Oof. Which got me to thinking, do either of you have a comic run, character series, etc., that made you feel seen in a way most others haven't? For example, I love Jason Aaron Russell Dodderman's run on Mighty Thor because I identified strongly with Jane Foster, who was going to a bunch of doctor's appointments in the hospital, but was still Thor.
Oh, wow.
Thanks so much for the hours of entertainment, Steve.
Wow. Interesting.
Anything jump out to you, Will? You want me to go first?
If you got one, go first.
So mine isn't a comic book necessarily, but when my son had was in the hospital, this was like 6 months after he was born. He had a really bad cold, RSV. So he's in the hospital for a week. And I was there largely 24/7. I would go home to feed the cats and go back to the hospital. And then my wife got sick. She caught it. And so she had to go home and recover. And so I was there alone. just overnight while my son, who couldn't talk yet, he was a, he's 6 months old, so he's real dumb.
Might have been 5 months, real dumb.
But it was just really sad. He was hooked up to cords. I couldn't like really pick him up and hold him.
Yeah, and he's confused.
He was putting up with it really well, but didn't want these tubes up his nose. He didn't, I wanted to take him home and take care of him, but I also had nothing to do. So I started binge watching Steven Universe.
Okay, yeah.
Which is a Cartoon Network show. And it's a show about a kid named Steven Universe whose mom is dead. His mom died to give birth to him in a way. It's a lot more complicated than that.
Yeah.
And I'm watching, and it's sort of a silly cartoon. It's like a kid with like superhero aunts taking care of him is basically what it feels like when it first starts. And then about like 10, 12, 14 episodes into it, he finds a videotape of his mom talking to him. Like she recorded this videotape for him that he had never seen. And he watches it, and I'm in this hospital with my son, and my mom has been dead since I was 12.
11, yeah.
And I'm just crying in the hospital. And this, and Steven Universe helps lots of people be seen. It deals a lot with identity issues and sexuality and all this other stuff. But right there in that moment, I'm like, well, this show will always mean a lot to me.
Yeah.
Because of that moment. And also I'm in this very emotionally vulnerable state while I'm watching it. And I was just a wreck. And I was also like, I'm going to keep watching it. And I've watched every episode and I've cried a number of episodes in the show.
Yeah.
That show can get me like nothing else. But that episode, I was just like, well, this isn't for kids.
Yeah.
This is, can't be watched by anyone who's under 40.
you're not emotionally ready.
And it was, I don't know. I love that show because of that reason.
Steven Universe is created
my son is fine.
Yes, a scary time that happily ended, that ended all right.
Yeah.
Steven Universe is created by Rebecca Sugar.
Yes.
And Rebecca Sugar drew one of my all time favorite comics.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. It's where they talk in Simpson quotes, right?
All the dialogue is Simpson quotes. I think 100% of it.
Yeah. There's some narration that's not.
Yeah, the narration is not, but it's a Barney quote is the title. It's like something, something, I'm already dead.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
From his like art film that he enters into something. And when
Don't cry for me, I'm already dead.
And it's like two brothers who both love The Simpsons and they quote The Simpsons to each other all the time. And then one of them gets in a serious car accident, but can only still speak Simpson quotes. And it's like 7 pages. It's drawn in this very pronounced style. It's very abstract and weird, and it is so moving and silly. I burst into tears the first time I read it, and it's incredible. And she was just like a student or something, but it got around. It was like, oh, you got to see this like comic. Don't cry for me, I'm already dead.
Yeah, you sent it to me. I remember you sending it to me, and I loved it.
And I was like, who is this? And then like a couple years later, like, and I think she worked on Adventure Time.
Yes, that's right.
And then like Steven Universe started, and it was like created by Rebecca Sugar and based on the Simpsons comic. I was like, this Steven Universe show is going to be great because it's the genius who did Don't Cry for Me, I'm Already Dead. And I was right. I'm, you know, dead mom stuff gets me all the time.
Dead mom stuff is an easy target for it.
Yeah.
But Steven Universe is also just legitimately
also
great.
Just
but
good, regardless of that.
It's just very weird to have like a 10-minute kids cartoon that starts off so silly.
Yeah.
And then become this cartoon that has made me cry 6 or 7. There's a song on that show that makes me cry every time that I hear it. And it's just like, well, this is insane.
Is it from their musical episode?
There's lots of musical episodes, but not the all musical episode. There's an episode where Pearl, the sort of the fastidious gem, is training Steven's best friend / love interest how to sword fight. And the song is all about Pearl. It's basically talking about how, like, look, people don't think you can fight because you're weak, but you're going to do it because you love somebody. Because Pearl was like a secretary gem who learned to fight to protect Steven's mother. And she loved Steven's mother. And it's heartbroken that Steven's mother died and fell in love with somebody else. But she still, you know, so it's like this song basically about where Pearl is like, I'm willing to die for this person. But also in the song, she's talking to this human being. And in the song, the human being starts singing along with it. And she's like, I'm worthless. All I'm good for is dying for this person. And it's such a heartbreaking story for both of them to feel that way. And Steven's sort of watching it. He hates it and stops it eventually because he's like, this isn't, I don't want this. Yeah. I don't want you to die for me. It's not what I don't, I would never ask anyone to do that. But like that, they both feel that way. It's just, it's a brutally well-written song where I don't necessarily relate to those feelings in that way, but I can't not feel it. It's written so well.
I mean, Rebecca Sugar and everyone who works on that show, incredible.
Yeah.
Massive talent. Really, really fun. I don't know if I have an example as good as that. The first thing, I'll just say the first thing I thought of was the comic book Zot by Scott McCloud, which went for 10 issues of this like alternate universe where it's like a sunny 1950s thing where the good guys are good and the bad guys are bad and good stuff always happens. And then Jenny is this girl from our Earth who visits there and she can't believe there's no cynicism there or whatever. But then after the 10 issues in color on Zot's world, they move to black and white issues in Jenny's world where Zot, this like idealist do-gooder character, has to reckon with like all of Jenny's real life problems of like divorce and being left out and being bullied. Multiple times in that comic series, I felt like this is the real world. I was blown away by it. So I will say Zot's black and white issues are the ones where I felt in different ways represented and seen. The kids were doing their best. The adults were bad, but not 100% bad. It was just like broken people doing their best and failing. And I was like, this is the real world. This is like, nobody was 100% bad or good, I felt. And I was really, Scott McCloud is most famous for doing Understanding Comics, the sort of academic examination of the mechanics of comic books. But he also is the creator of Zot. And I think Zot is, I think that's what he should be known for. I think it's amazing.
Yeah. It's sort of a sad that he didn't get to do, or that he chose not to do more comics.
But he did one terrific one, and that's more than a lot of people do. So,
I mean, he does what he wants to do. Steve, who asked us this question, it's also Will Macaroni on the What's in the Box show.
Oh,
that's the show you do with Chris Gathard and Christy Cello.
Yeah, that's right. I love it. It's truly one of the most fun games I've ever seen. What's in the Box, in a completely insane and unwinnable game. Not totally unwinnable, but like insane.
I'm going to do, we got a bunch here. I'm going to do three more because I think we can do them quick.
Okay.
Or two of them are very quick. This one's from William Dunbar. It's pretty recent. Have you guys seen the new huge Daily Bugle set from Lego? Have you seen this, Will?
No.
You got to Google it. It's an enormous Lego set of the Daily Bugle. It comes with 25 minifigures, including J. Jonah Jameson, the rest of the Daily Bugle crew. No enforcers, unfortunately, but maybe next time. It is enormous. He asks if we're planning to get it. I am not. My son plays with Legos, but we get him like small kits.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get him a giant set. He will just knock it down. I don't know where you put things like that. People who keep Lego sets all the way up, I'm just like, wow, you must have huge houses. Anyway, it's worth Googling because it is in a ridiculously fun looking set.
That sounds cool.
Here's one from Kelly. It's a long one, so I'm going to read it a little fast. There's no question here, but I think it's interesting. We get a lot of emails like this. I started listening to your podcast after hearing Will on How Did This Get Played? Mm-hmm. Started reading the old Ditko Spidey comics along with your podcast and ultimately was inspired to follow a longtime childhood dream of mine. I turned 50 a week ago and I started reading almost exclusively Marvel comics in the early 80s. And I could only wonder at the 20 years or so of lore that I'd never know. When the official handbook of the Marvel Universe was published, I devoured them and the richly vivid character histories they revealed, even though I started with the Book of the Dead and Inactive as my morbid way. Well, I'm a middle-aged man of some small means and an iPad now, so I decided I was reading Spider-Man that I should sign on to Marvel Unlimited and simply read the main Marvel Universe, what with it being an actual possibility now and all. What Marvel Unlimited couldn't provide due to licensing, Micronauts, ROM, Space Knight, Conan the Barbarian, many limited series and so on, I'm finding through other sources. I have a surprising amount of access to all those mysteries and unknown tales. Also harder reading than I expected. One, expletive deleted Ant-Man. I guess he doesn't like Ant-Man. Two, more talking than I expected, even though it's pitched at this time towards 10-year-olds. Three, it took more years than I thought for Marvel to really find its footing. Hmm. Still, the writing and art were more evocative than I'd expected. And even when it was weak, Ant-Man, I was having a good time seeing the foundations and evolutions of these characters, along with your podcast, now one of my favorites. I've moved to the 60s, up to June 1973, and I'm really enjoying the sudden depth and range the decade has ushered in. Let's just say you can really tell when the Comics Code relaxed its stance on monsters and comics. The renewed emphasis on social issues and diversity, albeit through the unpolished and foggy lens of the 70s, took me by pleasant surprise. It might be heavy-handed, but Marvel pushed social issues and justice hard from the beginning, and people who complain that Marvel should stop pushing social justice warrior politics are almost as bizarrely unself-aware as Star Trek fans complaining about the same thing. I got to so many exciting stories and characters, not least of all, the appropriately physics-based death of Gwen Stacy. I wanted to thank you, Fine Milksops, for inspiring me to follow through on a kid's dream. I have a bad feeling I'm not going to stop in the early 80s as planned. And you know what? That's just fine. Like the man said, make mine Marvel.
Ooh.
It's from Samuel, full-grown adult. A lot of people email us saying they're reading all of the Marvel comics, which is why I wanted to read this email. That's interesting. An enormous undertaking.
An enormous task. And a lot of them aren't good, right? Like, I feel like there's a lot of great stuff in there, and a lot of like just filler stuff where they were sort of just, they had to grind out an issue or whatever. And
yeah, I mean, they weren't planning on these comics being around forever. No one thought.
Yeah. They were written for that month only. Yeah. They weren't building Ant-Man to hold up a mythology later.
Yeah. No one thought that even Spider-Man, which is great. Like no one thought in 2020, people are still going to be reading these same stories.
Right.
They'll be reading whatever's new at that point.
Yeah.
Collections weren't a thing. Marvel Unlimited was not a thing. Movies based on these characters was not a thing. So they were just putting stuff out to make a buck sometimes. Some stuff they cared about more than others. And when people read it all, it boggles my mind. It seems cool to me, but I'll never do that.
But thank you so much for being inspired by anything we did and for telling us about it.
Great. And I'm going to do one last one, which means we'll have to do another one of these episodes soon, Will, because we still have five emails, not counting whatever we get in the next couple of weeks. This is from Daniel. Hello, Milksops. Long time, first time. My wife and I are big fans of your shows.
Another couple.
We get a lot of couples. Yeah. On the recent first
X-Men.
We're kind of
love gods.
Yeah, we're sort of like a Cupid. We bring couples closer together. Yeah. That is given. There's something about us. We are Spanish fly.
That's like sex stuff, right? That's like an aphrodisiac.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We're like horny goat weed. This bit has gone awry.
On the recent first X-Men mailbag, an insane format, by the way. Thank you. You were talking about the indelible impact of the movies on the comics, citing specifically Hugh Jackman and Wolverine. I think Jackman was a great Wolverine Logan, way too tall, but oh well. I don't want to take anything away from his performance or contribution to the character. When Kevin said, I pointed out the line every time in regards to if it hurts when his claws pop, it reminded me of a scene in Wolverine 75. So this is 1993, he thinks. That always stuck with me, and it's the encapsulation of what I think people love about the character. The scene is at the end of an extra thick anniversary issue that sees the aftermath of Magneto pulling the adamantium from his skeleton. The issue is full of violent, savage imagery, but the last few pages are a conversation with and letter to Jubilee. Jubilee is like a young teen girl that he's sort of a father figure to.
Yeah,
it's a very sweet moment when she's getting advice from Logan, and there's an exchange that includes something really similar to the Every timeline. Also, a butterfly lands on one of his gnarled bone claws. It effing rules. Anyway, all of this is just to say, I think the game for Wolverine for a long time has been to play with that contrast. Wolverine is the most skilled killer in the world, the best at what he does, but damn it, he's got a heart. Love you guys. And that's true, definitely. That I sort of credited that scene with a lot of it. But I think I mostly meant like for me, I may have said this differently, but for me, it made me see Wolverine in a different light. If that existed in the comics, I had not seen that, having not read a lot of the Claremont X-Men.
Right.
And his guest star appearance is not really carrying that.
Yeah.
But it's true. Wolverine often gets, like, he and Kitty Pryde had a relationship too, right? He often gets paired with like young girl characters where he's protecting them.
Yeah. Wolverine and Kitty Pryde was like a 4-issue miniseries, I think, or something like
that. Yeah. And then he had it again with Jubilee. Mm-hmm. And then
do you hear these sirens on my side?
I heard a little bit of them. Yeah.
Okay.
And then it was also, the second Wolverine movie has that little bit of it going on. And Logan, of course, has it with X-23.
Yeah.
So definitely a part of Wolverine to do that.
Where do you put Logan in your ranking of superhero movies?
I don't hold it as highly as most people. I like it a lot. It didn't.
I put it high. I've seen it 3 times and I'd watch it again right now.
I've only seen it once though. I also really liked The Wolverine, the second Wolverine movie, a lot more than most people. I think that
the first Wolverine movie is like universally bad, right? That was like this kind of tossed off, not good thing.
The Wolverine Origins movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's atrocious.
And then the next one is like pretty good. And that's the same guy who does Logan, James Mangold, right?
Yeah, I think The Wolverine is really good. The ending sequence is sort of a little generic-y CGI fight going on there. But other than that scene, I love all that movie.
Yeah.
I like Hugh Jackman in that movie a lot. I think he gets some nice stuff to do. I like the characters in it. They're just both really fun characters. Like there's the girl that comes to recruit him and then the girl he falls in love with. And I like both of them. I think they're both really great, fleshed out, interesting characters. The fight on the top of the train is really good. So I hold that movie up higher than most people and Logan down closer to that. Like I think Logan's better, but not by a lot. I like them both a lot, those two movies. So
cool.
I can't do a ranking of all superhero movies anymore because it's
there's too many. There's too many.
It's too many. Civil Winter Soldier is probably still my favorite.
It's a great one.
Yeah. Any thoughts on Wolverine before we go, Will?
I like him.
All right. I don't think he's got legs, but okay. So that's the end of our mailbag for this week, Will. We'll do mailbags two is over.
We'll do another one soon. Please all keep right. emailing us, screwitcomics@gmail.com, screwitcomics on Twitter, screwitcomics on Instagram. And
And come back next week. We'll be talking about Superior Spider-Man issues 7-4.
Four to seven.
Let me look it up real quick. It'll be issues because we just did
one,
two, and three. Oh, so right. So it'll be a 4, 5, and 6. We'll be focusing on 5, talking about 4 and 6 as well.
All right.
So then after that, we'll do 7, 8, 9, and 10 after that.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. Right. We'll see you soon.
Bye.
Bye. Screw it.
We're just going to talk about comics.
Oh, hello, you.
What's up, hoes?
I'm Mary Kay McBrayer.
I'm Mary Amelia Byer.
I'm Rachel Estridge.
And we like scary movies.
Let's be more specific. We like analyzing scary movies.
Okay, but let's be a little bit more specific. We like making fun of scary movies.
Let's be even more specific. We have to make fun of scary movies so that we can sleep at night.
We host a horror comedy podcast called Everything Trying to Kill You that rips all your fave horror movies a new one.
And bonus, we'll tell you jokes from the perspectives of
feminist ethnic minorities
and queer women, which might be something you haven't considered before.
Sure looks like Hollywood hasn't.
So check out Everything Trying to Kill You. New episodes every other Friday on Campfire Media.
Campfire.